The hour 1 o'clock having arrived, I will call a meeting to order of the Ag Finance and Policy Committee here in the Minnesota House. We do have a quorum, and Representative Harder, have you had a chance to check the minutes from the last meeting?
Yes, Chair Anderson, I have, and I move the minutes. Thank you.
Discussion, seeing none, all in favor of the minutes, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. The minutes are approved. Fairly busy day again today. First up, we'll have House File 2878 with Representative Murphy. And I will move the bill, Representative, and tell us about your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. First of all, this is my first opportunity to be in the Ag Committee, so I brought some treats to pass around.
We can vote
my
now.
My whole
we'll
life
vote.
Is agriculture. I grew up on a dairy farm, owned a dairy supply business for 26 years, and I currently sell in the ag market. So definitely agriculture is very important to me, so I brought you the really extra special button cookies. So that'll be good. So I'm going to tell you a little bit about House File 2878. This bill allows commercial feed businesses to employ veterinarians. The purpose of a bill is to improve opportunities for veterinarians, new and the ones that are aging out, to improve availability for needed services for livestock producers and pet owners. I want to support our livestock producers and agriculture in our state. Local vet businesses are crucial to livestock producers, livestock industry, and our state's economy. Pet owners want good outcomes for their pets as well. All of this requires the local attention of veterinarians. Young vets are strapped to school death. They often are in a possession because in the a profession because they want to practice as a veterinarian. Rural opportunities are shrinking, so starting or buying into an existing vet business are happening less. In a small ag business, this is our retirement. In 2018, after 26 years, I sold my ag business, but ag businesses are difficult to sell. Retail and service ag businesses on aging vets want to sell their practices have been unsuccessful in my area. Aging vets would benefit when they work and consult with prospective buyers as their business transitions ownership. This bill will improve options for aging vets exiting their businesses. In 1997, we made changes to the state a law to limit employment of veterinarians to vet-owned businesses. I'm working with the Minnesota Veterinary Association to ensure that best practices are kept to protect the interest of veterinarians, but this will definitely be a step in the right direction to open this up to commercial feed businesses. With that, I'd like to introduce my testifier, Mr. Joe Dahl from the Perham area, and his two sons are also in the room.
Mr. Dahl, welcome to the committee. State your name and proceed with your testimony.
Hi, my name is Joseph Dahl. I'm from Perham, Minnesota. I'm representing J&L Nutritional Consulting in the backyard boarding in Perham, Minnesota. My two sons that are co-owners with me are right over there, Tyler Dahl and Taylor Dahl. In Perham, Minnesota, we're known as the Lakes Country. The decline of the dairy industry has prompted our family to diversify. With our two sons returning home after college to join a business, we transformed our feed store to also cater to pets, offering grooming, boarding, play care, and canine training. Now, I've spent 35 years in the nutritional consulting, where I walk calls, examine the feedstuffs, balance the rations for optimal production. Over the past decade, I observed a growing need for veterinarian work, while access veterinarian work has become increasingly limited. And now we are faced with critical shortages of veterinarians. Over the past 10 years, many vets within 25-mile radius of Perham have retired or closed their practices. For instance, in Otterdale, Minnesota, the vet clinic closed there because she preferred practicing medicine rather than managing a business. Similarly, in Pelican Rapids, Minnesota, a vet clinic closed their veterinarian clinic there. In Perham, we've also had one shut down 2 years ago. Same thing, two veterinarians, both gone. Another one in Perham also just quit this year. Another one in New York Mills quit in the last 12 months. Two veterinarians again gone. As a result of the pet owners and livestock producers are struggling to find veterinarian services, with many clients refusing to accept new clients and appointments, wait time stretching for weeks and even months. To help address this issue, we believe businesses with commercial feed license should allow to employ veterinarians. By permitting businesses with commercial feed license to employ veterinarians, we can create a new opportunity for veterinarian professionals to practice medicine without the burden of business ownership. The change would also provide much needed relief to the countless animal owners who are struggling to access veterinarian care for animals. I continue with one of my other nutritional consultants to walk dairy and beef herds 3 to 4 days a week. This is a real struggle because we don't have the veterinarians in our area to help take care of some of these animals, and especially in the pet business as well. Dogs and cats not being vaccinated for 3 to 4 months, not getting the proper flea and tick protection as well. So that's what I got.
Thank you.
Mr. Dahl, thank you for your testimony. But, it hits home when you talk about all the vets in your area that have gone out of business, and this is a problem. We need to address this. We have another testifier, I believe, Dr. Trevor Ames, Minnesota Veterinary Medical Association. Welcome, doctor. Identify yourself and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Chair Anderson and Chair Hansen and committee members. I'm Trevor Ames, a retired veterinarian representing the Minnesota Veterinary Medical Association. I spent my veterinary career at the University of Minnesota, where I worked for 44 years, and 12 years of that was as the dean of the college. I want to begin by thanking Representative Murphy for his effort to look for solutions to the rural veterinary shortage issue. Certainly, complex problems require many possible solutions. The Minnesota Veterinary Medical Association, the University of Minnesota, and the USDA have all been integral in finding some solutions to deal with the rural veterinary shortage. In addition, the state of Minnesota has played a very important role with the passage of the Veterinary Technician Licensure Bill, and also through funding the Rural Food Animal Loan Forgiveness Program since 2009, which has been remarkably successful, with 95% of recipients staying and working in rural practice areas of Minnesota. And again, the MVMA appreciates the intent of this legislation proposed by Representative Murphy, but is unclear how the current Veterinary Practice Act is an impediment or how the professional licensing of feed mill provides a remedy. This bill would allow companion animal veterinarians to work out of a feed mill as a place of business, in addition to food animal veterinarians who make farm visits to deliver care. The MVMA is concerned about the appropriateness of feed mills as a location for a small animal clinic location as well. So given these concerns and questions listed, the MVMA is unable to support this bill at this time, but looks forward to working with Representative Murphy to resolve these issues. I've just been informed that the Minnesota Board of Veterinary Medicine will be working with Representative Murphy also to help resolve some of the questions that they had regarding this legislation, and the MVMA certainly looks forward to learning the outcome of these discussions. Thank you.
Dr. Ames, thank you for your testimony. Good seeing you again.
Good to see you too.
You know, you mentioned the Veterinary Loan Forgiveness Program. In the proposed governor's budget, that in the higher ed bill, that may be eliminated. But as you mentioned, it's been an integral part of helping veterinarians stay in the rural areas, correct?
Yes. I mean, that's an outstanding success rate compared to other loan forgiveness programs. So.
Yeah, 95%.
Yeah.
Anybody from the audience who would care to offer testimony? Seeing none, we'll open it up to member questions on the Murphy bill. Representative Nelson.
Thank you, Chair Anderson, and thank you, Representative Murphy, for bringing this bill. You know, it's the loss of veterinarians and just kind of the changing landscape of livestock agriculture in Minnesota is, you know, it's it really shows the need for this. And I think, as your testifier stated, you know, there's a lot of veterinarians out there that want to do vet medicine. That's what they want to focus on. But one of the challenges of when you have to combine that with running a business, you know, sometimes somebody is a really good doctor, but they might not be really wanting to focus on the business side of things. And, you know, that's a challenge, and I think being able to partner with that, it brings a solution to the table that I think we need. And I think we need to continue to look outside of the norm to be able to continue some of these practices and really bring the need of veterinarians helping sustain their career choice in our rural communities, because you know, there's oftentimes they're a very good veterinarian, but they may not always be a good business person, or I mean, really, frankly, the time to be able to also devote to running the business, and that's a challenge. And so being able to combine this and really bringing a solution forward, and I just want to thank you for that.
Comment, Representative Murphy?
Yeah, thank you, Representative. You know, I think that's exactly right. Most vets just want the flexibility of doing this. And, you know, it's they'd be eligible for some help if we made it so that other businesses could come in and help them out a little bit. We are severely short. The fact of the matter is, in just my immediate area, we've lost five people that would have loved to have sold out. And I sold my business, and I can tell you what that looks like when you have to negotiate that deal. And it's not always easy. You want a lot of options. But our aging veterinarians do not have that in rural Minnesota. They do not have the option of helping them sell out. And the young veterinarians want a different life. They don't want the same life in a lot of cases. This just builds some opportunity for veterinarians to be able to negotiate and have a little more flexibility. So I think that's the core of what this does.
Representative Vang.
Recording in progress.
Right.
Try it again.
Sounds good. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Maybe Representative Murphy, thank you for your bill. I just have a question. Maybe the testimony or testifier has already elaborated on this already, but how are you guys currently using veterans right now?
Representative Murphy, did you hear the question?
Yeah. How are you guys using? Yes.
Oh. Yeah, our company is using veterinarians. We embrace veterinarians. I need veterinarians to work with. I work with a lot of them one-on-one, actually, with our dairy operations. We follow up with herd checks, breeding, all kinds of synchronization, what we can do to make the farmer more profitable. The beef cow-calf operation, the same thing. I need veterinarians to be able to work with them. So, yeah, we work with them very, very closely. All my dairy and beef customers, when they need a VFD, then the veterinarians that have been on the farm that work with them, they distribute the VFDs to us, correct.
Thank you, Mr. Dahl. A follow-up, Representative?
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. Yeah, I mean, I think it's interesting. I mean, I do agree we do have a vet shortage, and I'm not sure if this bill actually does quite that, because even now you're still using veterinarians, and so having to allow you to employ veterans, I don't think it increases more opportunities since you're already using veterans right now. So I'm not sure if it actually solves the need of the veteran shortage. So I think I don't think it's a bill that's quite there yet, but I appreciate the thought and the consideration that the issue of veteran shortage is something that we need to address.
Thank you. Any further comments from Representative Burkle?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a quick comment. Glad to be a co-author on this bill. We have the same issues in Northwest Minnesota. You know, retaining, getting new vets to move into rural areas is really tough. And not just large animal vets, but we're seeing the same thing on the poultry side. Poultry vets are hard to find, too. So I'm just curious, and you kind of answered the question, but I would think what you're trying to do here is lower operational costs for your business and provide those opportunities for veterinarians. How do you see this working that way? And I'm just wondering, because to me this would expand that opportunity and allow that vets to have that opportunity.
Question to whom, Representative?
Probably the testifier or Representative Murphy, either one.
Mr. Dahl,
what this would do is you hit it right on the head. A lot of veterinarians after graduation, to get them to come to rural Minnesota is very difficult. A lot of them are they have a huge debt after graduating from veterinarian school. They need to start a family, and then you buy a house and everything else. It becomes really difficult for them to do that. The other part of the practice that we've seen, and I know a lot of vets. I work with a lot of vets. The five ones that just closed, actually in the last 3 years, I worked with them one-on-one. And their biggest concern was the hours a day that they're putting in for veterinarian service. The other thing was the fact of the matter that they don't want to manage a vet clinic. And it becomes, like the one said, he said, I can get kicked, I can be scratched, and I can be bit, but I don't have to worry about being talked back by people. And it kind of sums it up. So the biggest thing is getting vets to move into rural areas, northern Minnesota, central Minnesota. It's very difficult. And if we can provide that, it makes our occupation so much better because we can get timely vaccination protocols, timely appointments. People can get in there on a timely basis to get their animals treated. And it's humane to do that. You have to do that. We owe that to our animals and to our livestock and to our production people. The agriculture community needs that.
Any comments, Representative Murphy?
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Burkle. Just to comment on your question a little of how you see the scope being done. Really, we don't anticipate the scope being done. They're still going to have the same guides as before. I'm talking to the Veterinary Association about the governance and what it looks like to make sure that veterinarian has all that the same tools that he's accustomed to. It's just his employer would be different. And so allows him to practice his craft without all the added weight of owning a business. And that's what a lot of our young people want. And to go with Representative Vang's question, too, is it's really about location. We use a vet today, but how much longer? We lost five. How much longer will we have somebody in the area where the industry doesn't say, I think I'm done. There's nobody around to help me with my problems, or I can't get them in a timely fashion. And then that'll be done. Then that'll affect the industry of agriculture, whether it's poultry or whether it's beef or whether it's dairy. And so that's what we want to prevent. And it's a lot of times the same veterinarians that are actually working on your pets. And so we need to have them in our local communities, and that's the real challenge.
Follow-up, Representative Burkle.
Just a quick comment. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I completely agree, and that's the issue in small rural towns all over the state. And I can speak personally to that and attest to that personally with the poultry vet situation. We'll drive 5 hours to find a vet where I live. So it's disappointing to see this loan forgiveness program go away. I would hope something like this might expand some opportunities. But in the end, with the debt load a vet student would carry, we need the governor's budget to look differently on that in that scope or in that front. And I would hope we could maybe somehow address that in the coming weeks as the budget comes together, because it's serious in rural Minnesota and the vet shortage is a real problem.
Final comments, Representative Murphy, on your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I've talked to many veterinarians and livestock producers. This bill will help. Today, the outlook for rural veterinarians, producers, and pet owners is not good in rural Minnesota. And so I intend to work with the groups that represent veterinarians. We definitely want to keep them strong. And I want to work with this, but this is a good bill, a stone to help the young veterinarians and aging veterinarians move throughout the business and keep those veterinarians in place. So thank you.
With that, I'll renew the motion that House File 2878 be laid over. Thank you. Next up is Representative Nelson with House File 2667. Welcome to the committee, Representative Nelson. Well, you're a member anyway. So your bill is up 2667. Would you care to move it?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And it is always good to be in this committee. And with that, I would move House File 2667 before the committee.
And Representative Nelson, to your bill.
Thank you. House File 2667 is an attempt to clarify some language that was adopted last year regarding the licensing of restricted-use pesticide applicators. Last session, a bill was brought by the Department of Agriculture that was designed to make bring Minnesota into compliance with the federal EPA requirements concerning restricted-use pesticides. The end result is a bill is that the individuals who assist in the application with mixing and loading, they must now hold the same licensing requirements as what the applicator has. House File 2667 changes this requirement as long as the assistant is working directly under the supervision of the licensed applicator. The assistant would no longer be required to obtain the same license. And with me today, I have Bruce Claven, who can tell you a little bit more about the bill.
Welcome to the committee. Please state your name and begin your testimony. Thank you.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, Bruce Claven. I'm representing Minnesota Wheat Growers Association today and Red River Valley Sugar Beet Growers. Also, the aerial applicators have an interest in this bill. And as Representative Nelson indicated, this was brought last year. And in fact, it was Representative Vang, you may remember this, it wound up in your omnibus policy. It was Representative Purcell originally carried it. But the language that was adopted last year, you'll find on your bill from lines 1.7 to 1.14. All of that verbiage last year was passed as part of that bill, and it's federal conformity, and the department had to bring it. It's outlined in the Code of Federal Regulations, and that process started back in 2017. So the department went through their process of their plan review, and they brought this bill last year to be in federal conformity, and so we have to have that. And so we all listened, myself, my colleagues in the room, didn't think much of this definitional change, but the net effect after this passed was that we discovered that the application of the pesticide, that definition mattered more than we thought, because now anybody helping mixing, handling, and loading needs to get the same license. And so we started having a discussion about could we do this where the assistant, the person helping, can work under the supervision of the licensed applicator without getting the licensing themselves. And so that's really what the bill does. And so turning to that, mixing and loading on 1.9, the concept there was to delete 1.9 and 10, move mixing and loading down to 12, create a new definition of handler at the bottom of page 1, and that is out of the Code of Federal Regulations, and you'll see the key phrase there, 1.20, under the supervision of the licensed applicator. And then we turn to the back, and this says a person may not use a restricted use without having a license, except the handler, which is defined on the previous page, may engage in mixing, handling, and loading of the restricted pesticide under the supervision of the licensed applicator. Now, members should know that the licensed applicator does have some responsibility here to do some training, make sure that the assistant, the person helping, has safety measures, and there's a whole bunch of the stuff in the Code of Federal Regulations I could bore you with, but it's in here, it's in that reference section. And so that's really what the bill does, Madam Chair.
Thank you for your testimony. Does anyone else here wish to testify for or against House File 2667? Do you want to do the amendment now? Representative Nelson. On this bill, you did have an amendment.
I do have an amendment.
That we did not address.
Madam Chair, and it's the A1 amendment. And if I could, I would like to move the amendment.
All right. Representative Nelson moves House File or moves the amendment at the A1. Would you like to please explain the amendment?
Yes, the amendment, overall, it's really just adding the word transporting in. Behind mixing and loading, so it would allow them to transport the chemical. They're not applying it, but they would be moving it from maybe a centralized location to a field.
Thank you, Representative Nelson. Is there any discussion to the A1 amendment? Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and we generally would support the author getting the bill in the shape they would like.
Any further discussion? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, say nay. The motion prevails and the amendment is adopted. Okay, now I'll go to, is there anyone who would wish to testify for or against House File 2667 as amended?
Yep. Madam Chair, if I could, I was asked by the Farm Bureau to throw their name in support as well, and I forgot to do that earlier.
All right, thank you for that. Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Could the Department of Agriculture come forward?
Good
Welcome. Please state your name and begin your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Good afternoon, committee. For the record, my name is Peter Chesed. I serve as an assistant director at the Minnesota's Department of Agriculture.
President Hansen.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Mr. Kethis. So looking at 18B01, this is restricted use pesticides. So those would be the most toxic, the most harm either to the individuals who are handling them or to the environment. Is that correct?
Madam Chair, yep. Representative, yes, this pertains to restricted use pesticides.
Representative Hansen.
And thank you, Madam Chair. And the bill as it's written with the amendment, does this deal with commercial applicators, non-commercial applicators, private pesticide applicators, or all of the above?
Madam Chair, Representative Hansen, I think at this time, if it would be all right with the committee, I'd like our division director, Josh Stamper, to come up here, and he's much more well-versed in the specifics of all of this.
Thank you. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and begin your testimony. Thank you.
Madam Chair, Chair Hansen. Chair Hansen, could you repeat that for me?
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Mr. Stamper, so would this apply to commercial applicators, those applicators who are being hired to apply the restricted use pesticide, non-commercial applicators, those people who are applying it as part of their job, or private pesticide applicators, those farmers who are applying it for their production of crops, or all three?
Madam Chair, Chair Hansen, it would apply to all three.
Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So the worker really doesn't have a choice if their employer tells them to do something, to apply mixing and loading or transporting the chemical, and that the protection of the existing law as it is would cover that they need to be trained. There would be a responsibility not just on the farm, but for those people that are being hired by farmers to go out and do that application as a commercial applicator, or if they were employees of, say, the Department of Natural Resources or Transportation who are applying the restricted use pesticides in the rights of ways or for forestry. Is that correct?
Go ahead.
Madam Chair, Chair Hansen, that is correct.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And this bill is being laid over, correct?
That is correct.
I think that's good. I think when we're retreating on safety for the workers by removing the training requirements, it's not something, I mean, it sounds like this is, it's an inconvenience for the employer versus protection for the worker. And by walking back, we're removing those worker protections. So, you know, we're not going to call for a vote on this, but I think it's something we should think about if it was moving on.
Representative Nelson.
Thank you. And to Chair Hansen, I would like to point out that it doesn't cover application. If you're going to apply, somebody in that way that is going to be in a, you know, applicating, you do have to have the license, you know, the proper licenses and things like that. This would here would strictly be for the mixing, the loading, and the hand transporting of it. So that, you know, there is still, you know, if you're going to be a, you know, part of the application of it, you do have to have the proper licensing to do so.
Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. A lot of the spills, accidents occur during mixing and loading. You're dealing with a concentrated product or in transportation on the public roads. Accidents happen, and they usually happen at mixing and loading or in transportation.
Any further discussion from members? Anyone else here wishing to testify for or against House File 2667 as amended? All right, seeing none. Representative Nelson, do you have any final comments on your bill?
I just thank the committee for hearing it today, and I would just encourage that as it's being laid over, that we consider it to be added as part of the future omnibus.
All right, thank you. House File 2667 as amended is laid over. Representative Nelson, do not leave. The next bill on the agenda is House File 1795. Representative Nelson, please move your bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. 1795, I would move that before the committee.
Representative Nelson moves House File 1795 to be put before the committee. Representative Nelson, please tell us about your bill.
Okay. HF 1795, thank you, Madam Chair and committee members. House File 1795 is the, it's looking at funding for the Farm to School program. And it's something that it's also for early care, early childhood. It's allowing it as, in there as well. This has been a program that we've had for a while, and I think it's just important to continue to fund this. This program reimburses school district and early care settings for their purchases from Minnesota farmers, allowing them to serve locally grown and fresh food to their children. You know, thanks to the work of the committee, that in-home and child care centers are also able to take advantage of this program. Now, the grannies have sourced a wide variety of Minnesota-grown products to be able to serve to our children, including fresh fruits and vegetables, eggs, local beef, pork, poultry, and also products like wild rice or maybe maple syrup and local grains. This program, I think, is a win-win for our communities and our local farmers, and we're also starting to see that relationships are being built. I know there's one farm in my district that has been able to have field trips for kindergartners coming out to their farm, and that they've been able to showcase a cheese that they produce and kind of build that link. And another important aspect of this grant is that kitchen grants can also be applied for. One of the challenges that many of our schools have is you would call them a heat and serve kitchen. They're not a full kitchen like we would see in many restaurants. It simply warms up food and puts that before the students. But this here allows them to get some necessary equipment to serve and process this food that can be allowed or sourced through this program. You know, that this is for students all over the state. In my district, the Hinckley-Finlayson School has been able to serve some proteins and source them directly from some livestock farmers in the area, and it's been just a great opportunity for that. We're seeing more and more demand for this program every year, and in 2023, we had a federal infusion of funding, and there were $5.3 million in request for this funding. Right now, we fund this program at about $1.29 million, and it also has a coordinator, and I believe the coordinator is here today if there's any questions, it funds a coordinator to help facilitate the farm-to-school grant program. And so I do have a couple of testifiers. I believe they are on Zoom, so we can turn to them if they are ready.
Thank you, Representative Nelson. First, we will go to Joan Olson. Please state your name for the record and then begin your testimony.
Right, thank you. Thank you, Co-Chair Anderson and Co-Chair Hansen and members of the committee for the opportunity to testify in support of HF 1795. I'm glad to share my support on behalf of the Land Stewardship Project, and I also want to thank Representative Nelson for authoring this bill. So for the record, my name is Joan Olson at Prairie Drifter Farm in Litchfield, Minnesota. My partner Nick and I have a 33-acre diversified vegetable farm. We raise produce and bedding plants for a community-supported agriculture program, local food co-ops, a restaurant, food shelves, and the farm-to-school program in three school districts. I'm happy to share my support for the farm-to-school and early care program as a farmer who sells to the Hutchinson, Dassel, Cocato, and Litchfield school districts. And then also just for a little background, both my husband and I also hold teaching licenses, so we actually came to farming through a teaching lens, so know that side of things very well. So farm-to-school creates a market access opportunity for our farm and others, and it's a really important part of our business model. We started selling to farm-to-school in 2020. Last year in 2024, farm-to-school was 10.6% of our farm income. And now in 2025, due to some shifting in markets and our farm plans, we're expecting farm-to-school to be 30% of our farm budget this year. We shifted more of our wholesale produce to that farm-to-school stream as well. We produce a wide variety of things for the school, including salad, cabbage, broccoli, cauliflower, squash, cucumbers, tomatoes, peppers, onions, carrots, and more. Farm to School really offers a diverse market because many of the ways that Farm to School shows up in our cafeterias is quite diverse. It allows for small purchases and larger purchases from farms so that we can meet both school and farmer needs. So in the school year, our farm mostly is selling in the fall because that's when we have produce available when the school is in session. A lot of things show up in the salad bar line, which is really diverse. But in the summer months, we also provide food for their summer feeding program, which is for our less students, but again, allows a lot of flexibility for smaller amounts of items for that market. Also, we'll provide for specific dishes, like a roasted root vegetable meal in the fall, and we grow vegetables just specifically for that meal for three districts. Farm to School also provides kitchen equipment grants to schools to allow them to do more scratch cooking. And in our school district, they've really built out their ability to preserve and take in food during the height of what is our summer season, that's our height. So they're preserving for the winter months, things like tomatoes, peppers for various dishes, pickles, all of the above. And really this kitchen equipment has been critical for our districts to really ramp up in their ability to process and preserve, and then also saves staff time on basic salad bar prep. Farm to School also allows students the opportunity to enjoy fresh, nutrient-dense food and be able to learn a little bit about where their food comes from, building a community connection between the students and farmers. So our kids actually attend Litchfield schools. They're 11 and 14. And it's really awesome to think that there's food coming right from our farm and other neighboring farms that hits their plates at school as well as home. And we love seeing Farm to School on our school menu calendar. We have it sitting in our laundry room. The kids get to choose their meals for the week. And it's awesome to see Farm to School when I know that either our food or another friend's or another neighbor's farm has produce or proteins or grains coming in. In the winter months, I actually sub at the schools. And when I go and see the lunch line, I'm actually blown away by how different it looks from what the lunch line looked like when I was a kid. I think we kind of take that for granted right now, but I love seeing the rainbow of food that's at the salad bar and knowing that food from farmers right around me is showing up in milk dispensers, the baked goods, main dishes and side dishes at various points during the year. So our Farm to School coordinator, who is Amy Haig, she's been here before your committee in the past. She's mostly been doing outreach in schools with younger students using Minnesota Ag in the classroom lessons that's happening with Harvest of the Month. But also a couple years ago, our farm contributed photos and videos of how carrots get from our farm to the school tables. So the kids, mostly the elementary school kids, got to see that process of seeing carrots come to the school. We've received some really sweet thank you notes from elementary school students during Farm to School Month, which is really fun to see. And actually this year we're working on a possible collaboration with a high school facts class. We're doing some crop trials for the U of M in terms of broccolini and how customers like that. So we're hoping we can pair up with the facts class to have our high school kids actually test out broccolini in the classroom. So this direct investment into our farmers and our schools is a really powerful way for our state to support, especially small and mid-sized farms and operations, and then create market access opportunities for growers. Farmers are really looking for and needing some stability in markets, as farming is inherently dependent on so many factors that are out of our control, like weather and pest cycles. And especially for farmers growing out or growing or adapting their businesses, Farm to School is a significant market. Though our farm smells a smaller amount of a greater variety of crops, Farm to School is also a really great opportunity to specialize in one or a couple of crops in what could be a really very stable and viable market. So investing just $1 in Farm to School generates actually $2.16 of local economic activity. And it's a win for everyone, especially in a state that considers agriculture at the heart of what we do and who wants to support thriving rural communities. I was thinking back to my comment of like, oh, it's so great that there's local food at our school. And then I think again, well, shouldn't there be? You know, we are this rural agricultural community, and shouldn't our kids be the first people to get access to that fresh, nutrient-dense food? So we're really excited about federal funding for Farm to School, and we were saddened when we saw the federal cuts that were going to impact funding for the next 3 years. And in fact, my brother from Montana reached out when he saw that in the news and said, hey, are you guys going to be okay?
Ms. Olson, can you please wrap it up? We have a full agenda. Sorry about that.
So we're hoping the state can step in and see what a valuable program this is for farmers, school kids, and the local economy. We're really proud of this in our community, and thank you very much for your time.
Thank you, Ms. Olson. We appreciate your comments. Next up, we have Cindy Vanderpool. Please identify yourself and then begin your testimony. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair and Co-Chair Anderson and Co-Chair Hansen and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Cindy Vanderpool, and together with my husband, we own and operate Pastures of Plenty Farm in Kirkhoven, Minnesota. Based on the real impact this program has had for our farm, I'm honored to share the support for Minnesota Farms to School and Early Childhood Program. As a member of both, I am also proud to share the support of Minnesota Farmers Union and the Land Stewardship Program. With the snow that we're having today, as I'm looking out my window and our schools are closing, we didn't want to be too far away from our livestock, so thank you for the opportunity to testify virtually. I'll share a couple reasons why this investment is important to our farm and our family. First, our farm is now a fourth generation farm, raising livestock and supplying our community with sustainable raised beef, pork, chicken, and eggs. Since our farm was started in the late 70s until today, we have worked to grow our farm to support more of our family. And the challenges have been to find good, reliable markets. And for us, that's been the power of the Farm to School program. It's a connection that we can rely on to lock in our costs, plan for our production, and ensure that we have cash flow. Second, the conversation is timely because the federal government has canceled more than $13 million in funding that was allocated for the Minnesota Farm to School and Early Care Programming. This was devastating as we worked hard to put together bids to supply our area schools with quality local foods. We've even confirmed capacity with our local meat processors and hatcheries to ensure that we would have to partner with them to make sure that we had everything that we needed to go forward as far as, you know, having the right amount of chickens to supply for the schools, to have a slot for our processing for pork and beef. Those things all take time. It takes time to grow a chicken. And, you know, you don't want to have too much beef on your, too many steers on your yard all at the same time with a market that you don't have anywhere to go with it. So this funding is going to make a big impact, not only for our farm, but for other local businesses in our communities. The third and final is to give me a lot of pride that our products are going to feed local kids and to know that they appreciate it. We supply 17 dozen eggs a week to a school in the Morris area. And one week, because of the weather this year, they were not able to get our eggs. They were forced to use pre-made eggs that they had gotten off the food service truck. The kids were not happy. They wanted to know where their farm fresh eggs were from us. I appreciate the time that you have given me today to speak on behalf of our farm and our communities that would appreciate having local foods for our kids so that they know where their food is coming from and know that the impact of us not being able to sell to the schools not only impacts our farm, but three other communities and three other families. Thank you so much. Have a good day.
Yes, thank you for your testimony. Do any members have any questions for our testifiers? Hearing none, thank you both for joining us today. Does anyone here wish to testify for or against House File 1795? Seeing none, do any members have any questions for Representative Nelson? All right, seeing none. Representative Nelson, do you have any final comments on your bill?
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I'd like to thank my co-authors on the bill. I think it's a great opportunity to provide fresh local food to our schools and start building that connection with knowing your farmer. I remember I was in third grade, there was a producer came in, they were tap maple trees. and that I have a bad habit of tapping maple trees to this day. I didn't do it this year. Would have been a great year to do it, but just the timing didn't work out well for me. But, you know, I was able to learn about maple trees, and we had to, I think we had pancakes with maple syrup on it that day for lunch, and it was a great opportunity. And, you know, I think just having that connection, you know, I remember that from when I was little. And, you know, we've heard some of the testimony today of the, you know, the kids wanting their farm fresh eggs. And I think it's something that, you know, we need to instill healthy eating habits into our youth, and hopefully they'll carry on into their adult years. And I just look forward to the ongoing discussion on this. You know, the appropriation is blank, but I would hope that we can find some funding and fund this appropriately. So with that, I thank you, and I would move to lay the bill over.
Thank you, Representative Nelson. House File 1795 is laid over. All right, the next bill on the agenda is House File 2683. Chair Anderson, would you like to move House File 2683?
Madam Chair, yes, I'll move House File 2683.
All right, Chair Anderson moves House File 2683 to be put before the committee. Chair Anderson, there is an A1 amendment. Would you like to move your amendment at this time?
Yes, Madam Chair, move the A1 amendment.
All right, Chair Anderson moves the amendment one. Would you please explain the amendment?
Madam Chair, I think it's quite self-explanatory. A commissioner may use a part of these funds to handle the administration of this program. That's what the amendment does.
All right, Chair Anderson moves the amendment. Is there any discussion? All right, seeing none, all those in favor of the A1 amendment say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed say nay. The motion prevails and the amendment is adopted. Chair Anderson, would you please tell us about the bill as amended?
Thanks again, Madam Chair. This bill, we touched on it briefly earlier. But the idea from this came from the state of Nebraska, where they have implemented a program much like this. And it's a way for farmers to be proactive in trying to reduce their use of commercial fertilizer by way of using a biologic of, there are many different kinds out there, and a way that they could reduce fertilizer and yet maintain their consistent yields of, this would be in corn, by the way, in a corn field. And what the program would do, I'm not sure if we can get it done, set up in time for this spring, because even though it's have a foot of snow on my farm, corn planting will be hopefully just a couple weeks away. But anyway, I'd like to get the program at least set in motion. And what it does is, if a farmer can reduce his application of synthetic fertilizer nitrogen by 15% or up to 30 pounds per acre, he would qualify for a kind of a credit or bonus from this bill from the state. And I believe the language says not less than $5 per acre. So it's not a huge thing, but it just, I think, and I had a couple letters up there in my packet that I wish I had here, but I heard from a farmer from down by Laverne, and they've been using this program and have reduced their application of nitrogen and maintained their yields pretty much the same. And he supported the bill because he said it might give farmers who are kind of on the fence if they should try something like this or not. It might be a small boost to get them to try a program like this on at least a very limited number of their acres. And the bill does require at least a minimum of 40 acres to be eligible for the program. And I put that in there because You know, if you're going to raise 10 acres or 20 acres and get a $100 payment from the state, it's hardly worth the farmer's time or the state's time trying to administer all of that. So we have a minimum acreage number of 40 acres in the bill. That is pretty much what the bill does, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Chair Anderson. I have listed here the other testifier on this bill. Cameron Henning.
Yes, I'm present.
Oh, I'm sorry. I didn't know that you were remote. Thank you. Please state your name and begin your testimony.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair, Chair Anderson, Chair Hansen, and members of the committee. My name is Cameron Henning. I'm a commercial agronomist for Pivot Bio, located in covering southwest Minnesota. Included in this bill is a new program that would incentivize farmers who grow nitrogen-dependent crops, such as corn, to reduce a portion of their synthetic commercial nitrogen and replace that with a biological source of nitrogen to receive a cash incentive after the growing season when the practice change can be verified. I testified a few weeks ago on the types of products and technologies a farmer might use to qualify for the program. Biological products are one of the most rapidly growing areas of agriculture, with dozens of companies offering new products and solutions. If you have questions about the technology, I'm happy to revisit that. However, today I'm here to talk about the potential impact of the program proposed in House File 2683. The practice of using biological sources is important because there are a number of environmental benefits that come with making the switch. Even for just a portion of the nitrogen needs, biological sources of nitrogen do not leach and do not volatilize, and therefore do not contribute to the high nitrate, water, or nitrous oxide in the air. Rather, these forms of nitrogen are spoon-feeding the plant a portion of their nitrogen needs throughout the growing cycle with virtually no impact. If fully funded at $1.5 million and the rate remained at $5 per acre, the funding would result in over 8 million pounds of synthetic nitrogen avoided, which, when calculated at a 24% loss, is more than 2 million pounds of potential contaminants that were never applied to the soil. And this just represents the synthetic sources avoided. Farmers are still getting the benefit of a biological source, nitrogen source, meaning that farmers will likely maintain their yields and continue to be a positive impact to the Minnesota agriculture economy. I wanted to touch briefly on the success the state of Nebraska has seen in just 1 year with a similar proposal. That bill passed unanimously through the legislature, focusing primarily on the water quality benefits. The Nebraska Association of Natural Resources Districts testified recently that there were more than double the applicants as funding available, and that most of the applications came from areas of the state with a priority interest in reducing groundwater nitrates and runoff. The state is already looking for more funding to expand the program and impact even more acres. As the state continues to fund important work in limiting the effect of nitrates, Minnesota has the chance this year to adopt this proactive approach towards reducing nutrient use and help Minnesota agriculture become even more efficient while protecting vital natural resources. Not every tool or program will fit for every farmer in the state. While some of the existing programs will continue to be necessary, this program is another tool for farmers to use to address the perceived risk of the practice change decision and get them moving towards a more efficient source of nitrogen. Thank you for your time again today, and I look forward to any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Henning. Do any members have any questions for Mr. Henning? All right, seeing none, thank you. Is there anyone here who would like to testify for, I apologize, Representative Lee.
Thank you, Madam Chair, I apologize. And so, Mr. Chair, to the bill, is this, the program is it set up to be a one-time payment for that reduction and or is this an ongoing payment for as long as they, you know, maintain the reduction in the fertilizer use?
Chair Anderson.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Representative Lee. This funding is only for, would be for 1 year. And I would hope that, farmers have to try it. And if they see a benefit, then we would hope that there'd be enough support to make it an ongoing program. But as of right now, this would be kind of getting it set up this year and possibly used for the crop year 2026, but really just for 1 year, one crop year.
Follow up, Representative Lee.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And so, I really appreciate that answer. I think, going forward, if this is going to be ongoing, I think it should be clear in the bill if this is a one-time payment for just that one reduction, and then, if there's going to be more enrolled acreage, an additional payment or whatnot. You know, right now it seems it's unclear if this should be an ongoing payment going forward or not. And so hopefully we can get that clear up should this move forward. Thank you.
Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Representative Anderson. Is there any peer-reviewed independent research that shows that it does what it claims?
Chair Anderson.
I have seen some research. I'm not sure where it exactly came from. I haven't had time to really peruse it as carefully as I should. I have had anecdotal talks with a lot of farmers. When I visit with them, I ask them if they've tried this and not tried it. In fact, I think Representative Nelson has tried it, and he's had some results that at times were positive. So to answer your question, I don't have any data with me today that shows that it does work for sure. So that's why I think, you know, trying it for a year and seeing if it does work. I've heard great reports on it from some areas, but, you know, because of, you know, cold, hot, rain, dry, that type of thing, it may not be as consistent. I mentioned, I think, in the committee earlier that nitrogen is a difficult element to handle when you have a lot of rain like we had last spring and summer. A lot of that nitrogen was lost because it volatilized or leached down through the soil. So this would be a way, I think, to kind of stabilize at least that portion of the nitrogen, and it wouldn't be subjected to the weather in terms of leaching or a nitrification.
Madam Chair and Chair Anderson, may I add to that?
Yes, please go ahead.
I know our peer-reviewed research is out of Purdue and the University of Illinois to verify that we do, in fact, do what we say we're going to do as far as Pivot Bio goes, too.
Thank you. Is there anyone else who would like to testify for or against House File 2683 as amended? Representative Lawrence.
Madam Chair, thank you very much. And just a clarification, it seems like many times we talked about this bill, it's targeted for one product. And the bill is written that there's many options out there that may qualify for this isn't targeting just a one industry product. It's targeting the possibilities of any product that's on the market today that may reduce nitrogen. And so just wanted to clarify or bring to light that. Thank you.
Chair Anderson, do you care to comment? Or you just may...
Madam Chair, no, I agree. Thanks for bringing that up. We're not here to promote one product, but a number of products, a number of biologics. I've seen several of them at different trade shows I've been at, and they all talk about the same type of mode of action. So it's for any product out there that's available to reduce the application of nitrogen and maintain their yield at a steady pace.
Thank you. Any other members have questions for Chair Anderson or comments? All right, I am seeing none. Chair Anderson, do you have any final comments on your bill?
Well, thanks, members and Madam Chair, for hearing the bill. And I believe it's going to be laid over. And just thank you for your support, and we'll keep working.
Thank you. House File 2683, as amended, is laid over. The next bill is House File 2446. Chair Anderson, would you like to move your bill?
Madam Chair, yes, I will move House File 2446.
Chair Anderson moves House File 2446 to be put before the committee. Chair Anderson, there is an A1 amendment in members' committee materials. I understand that we are not moving this amendment, but is before us for discussion. Chair Anderson, can you tell us about the A1 amendment?
Madam Chair, yes, broadband has been thrown in with agriculture for our finance bill. And there's a bill that's been moving. It's been heard in several committees. I'm not sure if they've reached agreement yet. I think there was some progress made in the Senate this past week. So this amendment is not going to move any place, but it's just here as a reminder that this will be a part of our bill.
All right, Chair Anderson, thank you for that. I'm not sure if there's anybody here from deed office that was just a comment on that amendment. Not aware of anybody. Anyway, Chair Anderson, please present your bill.
Madam Chair, it's my pleasure to bring you a pretty thick bill. It is the department's wish list for the coming 2 years in the biennium. So I think it would be proper if we call up members of the Department of Agriculture staff to tell us what's all on their bill.
All right. I have first on my list, Andrea Volbo. Please state your name for the record and begin your testimony. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Madam Chair. Yes, for the record, my name is Andrea Volbo. I serve as Deputy Commissioner at the Minnesota Department of Agriculture. And I'll while my colleague is setting up, I'll let her. Her name is Michelle Medina. She serves as our Director of Government Relations for the Minnesota Department of Agriculture. So I want to make sure we can get to the last bill, so I will talk quickly. And you'll see we have a presentation here. We did go over this several weeks ago before we had the bill language, but we sort of rearranged everything to go in the order of the bill. So we can just kind of walk through those things as they go. So the first item you will see is for maintaining our current service levels. That's starting on line 4.21 through 4.124, or I'm sorry, 4.24. And then there's a little bit more in on page 15. But again, this is just maintaining the current service levels for the Department of Agriculture. As I've mentioned before, the cost of operations rises each year due to several types of increases, whether that's salary and compensation-related costs, other operating costs like rent and lease, fuel, utilities, IT, and legal services as well. So we'll need to continue to work. We've continued to find efficiencies along the way. We will continue to do so. We've been doing some of those, like holding open vacancies in certain programs and delaying hiring in other programs. But of course, this makes some decisions difficult as it affects the services that Minnesotans expect from the department. Next item, you will find on page 8, line 20. This is to increase the maximum administrative allowance for our Agri-Grant program. Many of you are familiar with that. It funds all sorts of things within our budget. The reason we made this recommendation is for a few reasons. There are several new grant administration requirements that were adopted during the 2023 legislative session. We also have a strong commitment to meeting and exceeding the Office of Grants Management requirements, as we discussed in the when you all heard the biofuel and infrastructure and the bioincentive grant program overview from the legislative auditor. The number of very small grants that we administer and the number of first-time grantees that we work with has grown significantly. In terms of the increased requirements, there's pre-award risk assessments. We have to review grant history and capacity, state and federal tax forms, financial statements, certified financial audits, internal control procedures, post-award evaluations, and so on. So, of course, as you can imagine, this has required significant staff resources, and thus we've asked for an increase in the administrative allowance under AGRI. Next, you'll find on the next page, page 9, line 16, where this is for the biofuels infrastructure grant. So this grant program provides funding to enable retail petroleum dispensers to replace or upgrade equipment that does not have the ability to be certified for E25 with equipment that's compatible with E25 and higher ethanol blends. The current eligibility requirements limit the funds to retail petroleum dispensers who have no more than 10 petroleum dispensing sites, and so the governor's budget requests that we change that to 20. Our program has awarded over $9 million to 60 retail fuel stations around Minnesota since its launch in 2022. So we do feel that these rounds of funding have made a significant dent in the number of eligible applicants with those 10 or fewer retail locations. So we think it's appropriate to increase it till 20. Next item you'll see is related to the Urban Ag Grant Program, also out of AGRI. This is on page 11, line 1 through 11.6. I'm sorry, through 11.3. So the current AGRI rider specifies that urban agriculture funds need to be used for urban youth ag education or urban ag community development. We have found that this limits funds to a very narrow scope of what urban agriculture has done. So we feel like expanding the program to include urban ag-focused training, acceleration, and employment will diversify the types of projects we're able to fund while supporting a broader spectrum of urban ag efforts throughout Minnesota. The next change you'll see next, I think it's out of order. Oh, no, sorry. Sorry, this is a big bill. is our green fertilizer reduction. That's on page 17.8. You'll see the cancellation for $3 million for a reduction. This is authorized under Minnesota Law 2023, Chapter 60, Article 12, Section 76. It was a one-time appropriation of $7 million that was made to us for grants to agricultural rural electric cooperatives to invest in green fertilizer production facilities. This one-time $7 million appropriation is available until 2032, and the $3 million reduction leaves about $4 million available for grants to cooperatives. Given the state's budget forecast, the MDA considered a multitude of cost reduction options while prioritizing the agency's core mission, and so reducing funding for a program with unspent funds at this time seemed like an option that we could pursue. So thus you will see that in the language on page 17. Next, you will see on line 17.6, the beginning, there's a few pages related to this for our Good Food Access Program update. So the Minnesota Legislature established the Good Food Access Program and the Good Food Access Program Advisory Committee back in 2016. The purpose was to increase the availability of and access to affordable, nutritious, and culturally appropriate food, including fresh fruits and vegetables for underserved communities in low-income and moderate-income areas. This, of course, is also funded through the Agri-Grant Program with a current base of $1 million per year. So we're asking for a couple of changes that you'll find out throughout the bill. So the statute contains somewhat rigid detail resulting in complex requests for proposals, or RFPs as we call them, that are challenging for applicants to navigate and determine their eligibility. So some of these came directly from them. The name Good Food Access Program has also presented some challenges while we tried to implement this program by suggesting that certain foods are inherently good. It is unintentionally implied that others are bad, which has created a stigma, especially amongst rural communities. And this frames the programs as being overly idealistic or disconnected from the local food preferences. So we've asked to change a couple of those items, which you'll see outlined again in the bill. Next is our Ag BMP program updates. You'll see that on page 26, line 7 is where it starts. So the purpose of the Ag BMP loan program is to provide low-interest financing through local lenders to farmers, ag supply businesses, rural landowners, and water quality cooperatives for the implementation of best management practices that prevent, reduce, or eliminate environmental pollution and provide climate change benefit. Deleting rural from the Ag BMP loan eligibility requirement will largely allow for loans that prevent, reduce, or eliminate environmental pollution and then provide climate change benefits or improve drinking water in areas of the state that tend to be less populated or developed but aren't technically defined as rural. You will also see in Subdivision 3, 26.10, as of right now, the Ag BMP loan program is only allowed to have a balance of $140 million. This is not a change to appropriate money. It's just to allow us to accept more money or have more money available for that program if you all decided to appropriate additional dollars. The next change item is 26 on line 26.17 for the livestock investment grant expansion. And I believe Representative Nelson had this bill. So this is also funded through the Agri-Grant Program. It specifies that eligibility is limited to individuals and entities eligible to own farmland and operate a farm in this state under Minnesota statute. This definition does exclude many tribal agricultural programs, which are often expanding into livestock production. So this would expand the eligibility to tribal governments that may or may not fit under the current statute. The statute also limits the program to specific livestock species, including beef cattle, dairy cattle, swine, poultry, goats, mules, farm cervidae, ratatae, bison, sheep, horses, and llamas. While this incorporates the primary species raised in the state, it excludes many other livestock that pose significant opportunity and are usually raised by small and beginning farmers. So this would update the language that other livestock species, such as rabbits, donkeys, alpacas, and aquaculture, are eligible for this grant. One also change to the livestock investment grant is under current policy, grants are limited to just 10% of the first $500,000 of qualifying expenditures. So you'll see starting on line 26.8 that we are asking to change that from the 50% of the first 20,000 of qualifying expenditures and 20% of the next 200,000 of qualifying expenditures. This also was by far one of the biggest requests we received from the public on changes to our Agri-Grant programs. Next change is the PFAS prohibitions on line 29.23 is where it starts. So we are working with MPCA on this proposal as well. The current language in Chapter 18B of Minnesota statutes required regarding the prohibition of cleaning products containing intentionally added PFAS on January 1st, 2026 was intended to reflect the language in Chapter 116 regarding product prohibitions for certain categories that take effect on January 1st, 2025 for the PCA. The current language in Chapter 18B only refers to cleaning products but should include all applicable categories listed in Chapter 116, such as fabric treatments. The next piece is for seed potatoes. So this takes several pages of the bill. So I will run through these, and if you have specific questions, we have a very smart person here who can answer them. So the recommendation repeals 21.116, which prohibits the use of any general fund towards the program. This does not exist for any related industries and creates financial risk for the program. With a limited number of participants in the program, if an unexpected downturn in the industry or major program expense occurred, it could quickly lead to insolvency for our seed potato program. The ability to lean on general funds if such an emergency occurred would add stability for the program and industry. We're not requesting a general fund appropriation for this purpose, but just asking to remove the prohibition for the use of general funds. In Minnesota, there are about 25 producers of seed potatoes. And so folks know, just to, so you know, when seed potatoes are certified, it means that they meet standards for freedom from disease. Planting certified seed potatoes is generally desirable for growers and required in some situations. Standards for seed potato certification are standardized amongst potato growing states, and over those standards change to reflect changes in the industry. So the requirements for the seed potato certification are contained in the statutes referenced here. So we're proposing to modify several areas of that to incorporate language from Minnesota rules that we've already created. Thus, again, we anticipated that if this is adopted, those would make those rules obsolete. So that covers several pages. So the next is our food licensing modernization. It's just going to take me a second to get there. Okay, so if you go to page 59.8 is where we start our food licensing modernization. So the governor recommends some changes to Chapter 28A and 31 to be amended to modernize the Minnesota Department of Agriculture's food licensing framework to simplify the administrative system for food licensing to allow for business evolution and innovation and to increase food license fees to maintain regulatory service levels in fiscal year 26 to fiscal year 29. We've had extensive stakeholder outreach on this and have had several conversations, and we feel we've come to a good proposal that is worth your review. It does propose to adapt the food licensing statutory structure to better fit current food business types and create a correlating fee structure that sustains current regulatory program capacity. So you'll be able to see over the next couple of pages the changes we make for certain categories and the corresponding fees. Next, you will see a change for our milk marketing modernization. That starts on page 72, line 1. So most Minnesota dairy producers sell their milk to other business entities, such as a dairy processor or milk marketing organization. These entities may use milk in their processing plant or further market it on behalf of the dairy producer. In recent years, the MDA has been made aware of several situations where dairy producers have not been paid for milk collected from their farms. In the follow-up to these situations, the MDA identified that the requirements for these entities needed to be modernized. There have been some situations where we have had no enforcement option because the milk buyer did not actually have a milk marketing license, as they owned a plant and were not subject to licensing, or because the current license had no actual criteria or parameters. So some of the changes we make here works to address that. Next, we have several changes to the Rural Finance Authority, or RFA, program. I'll walk through a couple of those updates. So you'll see there's several of these within our bonded programs. So we're changing the requiring that applications for bond-funded programs be for at least $50,000. Again, this is not a request for funds, just a request to set a minimum loan limit to ensure the administrative time used to process loans is effectual. So you'll see that in Subdivision 2, Subdivision 8, Subdivision 4, Subdivision 1B, and so on. Then we do ask to update the a qualifying net worth limit for the disaster loan program. This ensures that limited funds go to the most financially challenged Minnesota farmers during declared disasters and helps keep money in the account available to lend during disasters when it's needed most. And so you'll see that we have a $5 million net worth limit for that program specifically. Next, we also have a change to our microloan program. So as for many, many years, it's been called the Pilot Agricultural Microloan Program, but we've had this program around for several years, and it's been quite successful, so we feel like it's appropriate to take out pilot at this point. We also add in that land is eligible for financing as well. Again, this is under the RFA. And then also we have some changes to our Farm Opportunity Loan Program. This was established in 2015. Two of the primary categories are so broad that almost any farm practice or machinery could fall under that definition. We already have a pretty robust revolving loan account that can provide funds for the line items the RFA is looking to delete, and that is out of the AgBNP loan program that I referenced earlier. Also, a net worth limit is being proposed to ensure the limited revolving fund gets to the Minnesota farmers that need it most. And next, we have our grain license fees. So these licenses have not had a significant adjustment to their fee schedule in 20 years, but we've seen cost savings due to the repeal of bonding requirements, and we'll see additional savings if changes on financial reporting standards. Actually, those were passed and signed into law, first bill of the session. Thank you for that. Conversely, with a program change in recent years requiring annual inspections for all license holders and an expectation for substantial review of financial reports submitted by license holders, the program is not able to reduce costs. The MDA has a little over six FTEs working in this program, and we are not proposing to add additional staff. However, as costs have increased over the past 20 years, the MDA has reached a point where the revenue collected no longer supports the cost of operating this program. This program has operated at a loss during four of the five past years and is on track to be out of operating funds by the end of fiscal year 2026, thus the request in increased fees. We do estimate that the cost savings the industry will realize from the adoption of the policy changes to financial reporting requirements will be approximately $1.5 million. And then we estimate that the additional revenue brought into the MDA with this budget proposal will be about $450,000. And with that, Madam Chair, that is our bill.
Happy to answer any questions. Yeah, thank you for that. Anybody have questions for Ms. Valbo? Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Ms. Vobel, just following up on the rent and the lab rent, if you could just give us a clear answer on how much additional, we discussed this earlier, but what you see as the ongoing rent for the building.
Yes. Thank you so much, Madam Chair and Chair Hansen, for the question. So, yes, we do see an increase. We were alerted by the Department of Administration that we have an increase in our lab rent. We estimate that to be about $1 million per year. It's one that we had not been anticipating, but it is baked into the operating adjustment as requested in the governor's budget for the maintaining current service levels. So that is part of the request. It's a fixed cost that we just can't absorb and must pay. So. We would appreciate support in that area.
Representative Hansen. All right. Any other members have questions for Ms. Bobo? All right. Excellent job. Next on the list for testifiers, I have Laura Lemke. Please come to the table, state your name, and begin your testimony.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Laura Lemke. I'm the Executive Director of the Minnesota Grain and Feed Association. We are a 118-year-old voluntary nonprofit membership organization that represents the interests of the state's grain and feed industries. I'm here today to share our opposition to the grain licensing and inspection fee increases proposed in House File 2446. The grain industry understands MDA's grain program is operating at a loss and needs to find a way to cover the shortfall. They've been knowingly operating in a deficit for four of the last 5 years. And while I understand the logic behind their reluctance to raise license and inspection fees due to the ongoing changes being made to the grain buyer statute in recent years, those fees haven't been raised in 20 years. Now MDA is at a critical point. General funds are no longer an option to cover the shortfall. Instead, the grain industry is expected to shoulder the department's delayed decisions at an astronomical cost to their businesses. As I stated in my written testimony, this license and inspection fee increase will cost many state grain buyers and storage facilities between 40 and 250% more for their licenses. This is not a small bump to license fees. It's a huge increase. I have small independent elevator members who will see their license and inspection fees jump $2,000 or more in a single year, and larger cooperative elevator members who will see their fees increase from $18,000 to more than $40,000. For an industry that already operates on slim margins, this is a substantial increase we are being expected to absorb in a short period of time. This license fee increase will raise our cost of doing business at a time when grain markets are facing a lot of uncertainty, and the cost of everything is going up, from insurance premiums to wages for our workforce. In the past, grain buyers and warehouses have chosen to be state-licensed facilities because it was cheaper than becoming federally licensed. If this license fee increase goes through, the opposite will be true, and I will encourage my members to explore becoming federally licensed warehouses, which will reduce income for the department. MDA has testified that this needed fee increase will only minimally affect two-thirds of license holders. That is a cold comfort for the one-third of licensees that will be expected to pay anywhere between $1,000 more to $20,000 more in a single year for their grain license. MDA also justifies the license increase by saying that through recent legislation, they have saved the grain industry money by repealing the grain bond requirement and changing the financial reporting standards. I'd like to point out that phasing out a maximum grain bond costing $1,500 a year and turning around and charging a facility anywhere from $2,000 to $20,000 for their grain license and inspection isn't saving anybody money. I'm asking this committee to consider finding another way for MDA to cover their budget shortfall without gouging the grain industry. Whether we reduce the proposed cost of license fees and inspections within this bill, or we look at an increase in time between inspections from annually to maybe 18 months to 2 years. The fees as presented in this bill are simply unsustainable for our industry. Thank you.
Thank you. Does anybody have any questions for Ms. Lemke? Seeing none, thank you for your testimony. Is there anyone here who would like to testify for or against House File 2446? Seeing none. All right, I'll move to member questions. Do members have any questions on this bill? I'd say no. All right, Chair Anderson, do you have any? Chair Anderson.
Is it appropriate for me to ask a couple of questions?
Yes. You may.
If the department would come back up, I'd like to ask a couple of questions about the license situation.
Yes, you can.
Haven't had a whole lot of time to look at this or study it, but on page 76, line 28, it says a fee of $500 will be charged for each license location. What about a co-op that may have 5 or 10 different locations? How would they be assessed their license?
All right. Please state your name for the record and then proceed.
Yeah, Mark Abrahamson, the Plant Protection Director at the Department of Agriculture. So the answer is that the $500 fee would be per location.
Chair Anderson.
Madam Chair, thank you. So could you compare that to what they would be currently paying under the current license fees schedule to what a new one would be, for example, if they have 10 locations?
Go ahead.
Madam Chair. So I can say, generally speaking, that we acknowledge that the locations or the entities that have many locations will see a fairly big increase in their fees. The figure was given earlier, about two-thirds of our license holders will see a relatively small increase, less than $1,000. The smallest entities, I would say, is about 30 to 40 will actually see a decrease in their fees, but we acknowledge the biggest facilities will see a large increase. Part of our justification for that is we spend a significant amount of time on inspection with those facilities, so it is a fair share of where the program spends time.
Chair Anderson.
No questions. I would just throw out the idea of possibly putting a cap on this amount so that it wouldn't hit a firm, that medium-sized firm, so hard in 1 year. But that would just be a suggestion that I would make, possible amendment. But that's my question, so thank you.
Thank you. Representative Lawrence.
Madam Chair, before everybody leaves the table, might call him back. Chair Anderson triggered a couple more questions as he was kind of investigating there. Madam Chair, first question would be for the Minnesota Department of Agriculture is, maybe you've commented on the $500 charge. If a business says we have no grain facilities at this location, yet you're still charging $350 to inspect that location, even though it has no grain storage facilities. Could you comment on that, Madam Chair?
Who would like to answer that question?
Yeah, so the question would be the $350 minimum for a location. So every entity that's buying grain, we've got a responsibility to take their financials and review their financials. So there is a program cost associated with that. So that's, I think, where a minimum charge would come in. So even if they don't have a location we're visiting, we still do have program time that's being consumed by dealing with that entity. If we don't, there wouldn't be any other charge. So if they have no grain capacity at the location, there's no capacity charge. They're not storing that at the location. That would be the only cost.
Representative Lawrence.
Yeah, Madam Chair, kind of follow up, and I still am having difficulty seeing the necessity, based on what you just said, in the regards that they're not handling grain there. They're not storing grain. You have to have storage to handle the grain at that location. Still, what is the necessity for that location in particular? You commented the entity. I can understand the entity. But that location you'd be charging a fee of where there's no grain being handled.
Yeah, and if I'm interpreting everything correctly, the way I would see that is that is their participation in the program for holding a license, is they're paying the $350 fee. And even if we don't go and physically have to inspect, we still are dealing with that entity in terms of, again, with the financials, taking those in and reviewing them. So we do still have time and cost associated with a facility, even if we're not physically inspecting it.
Okay, Madam Chair.
Follow-up, Representative Lawrence.
We've got time, so I figured might as well. But a serious follow-up. In regards that, so just so I understand, right, so a location may still have a grain license, they may still maintain that, but not have facilities to store, correct? That's what I'm hearing.
That is correct. And we have buyers who don't physically, are not physically in Minnesota, but they hold a grain license.
Okay. Madam Chair.
Representative Lawrence.
Different question. Follow-up for me and from my knowledge more than anything probably, or maybe everybody's. As far as the inspection goes, you've got $500, and then we've heard testimony of the expense of the cost. As a state, what are we gaining through the inspection? What is the information that we're retrieving for that investment or for the charge that we're making on the license?
Yep. So we really see that as a key to the overall tracking of the elevator and their financial obligations. So we have the financial records, which we're reviewing. Then we have the inspection, which verifies that those two things jive together. As an example from the past, you know, the mandatory inspection really came part of the fraud with the Ashby elevator, where their books looked good, all the finances looked fine, but there was no grain that they said there was. And so in that case, an inspection would have determined that pretty easily.
Okay, all right. Madam Chair, I think that's good. Thank you.
All right, thank you, Representative Lawrence. Any other comments from members? All right, I'm seeing none. Chair Anderson, do you have any?
What? Well, as long as we have time, Madam Chair. All right. On a slightly different topic, I've had a couple of people call me about the situation of, we're talking grain elevators, about moisture testers, and does USDA calibrate them, or is there a state standard for moisture testers, or how is that handled in the state of Minnesota?
Yeah, it's a good question, and that has come up multiple times, and I have to say I don't have enough details on hand to be able to really speak well to it. I'm sorry. We could get back to you.
Okay. Appreciate that. If there's anybody else here or else I'd like to hear back, that would be fine.
All right. Thank you, Chair Anderson. Chair Anderson, do you have any concluding remarks on your bill?
No, I don't. A lot of material in the governor's bill here. I assume we will all peruse it carefully and come up with a bill. And I think with Chair Hansen, we have work to do and hope to be getting a bill out that you can look through by first part of next week, maybe by the weekend. So hang with us.
All right. With that, House File 2446 is laid over. The last bill on the agenda is House File 2916. Representative Smith, please make your way to the table and move your bill. Is he going to run back in?
Representative Smith, you want to move your bill?
Absolutely. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd like to move House File 2916 to be laid over for possible inclusion.
Very good. Tell us about your bill.
I have a lot to say about this great program in Olmsted County, but we are running a little low on time, and we have some wonderful testifiers specifically from came up in Olmsted from Olmsted County today in the not-so-great weather, so I want to make sure that they have an opportunity to speak, so I'll cede my time to them for now.
Very good. Thank you. Tell us who you are, and let's hear your testimony.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and members. My name is Skip Langer. I'm the Soil Conservation Manager with Olmsted County Soil and Water Conservation District. I appreciate the opportunity to come here today and speak with you. I'd like to talk about our Olmsted County Groundwater Protection Soil Health Initiative and the potential to expand this to the southeast region of Minnesota. Just for a little background, the conversations in Olmsted County surrounding the soil health program started back in 2021, and it was relating to one of our commissioners, family business, well driller, finding that they were rising costs to landowners to drill deeper wells in order to get into a portion of the aquifer where they were getting out of the nitrate reaching that 10 parts per million, which is our drinking water standard. That kind of led into discussions about what we might do to create a protection program for groundwater, which led then to an opportunity to think about soil health practice implementation. And so thus began the work, 18 months of time to develop a good program that worked for farmers. And so we developed a pilot. 2023, we were lucky in Olmsted to have access to ARPA funding, a reserve pot of funding through that federal program to get the program kickstarted. And as you know, in 2023, we also had an Environmental Protection Agency petition into southeast Minnesota that found that nitrate is a public health threat to folks that have the private drinking water wells. Another source of information that kind of helps also solidify sort of the sensitivity of the karst landscape in southeast Minnesota was the Minnesota Department of Ag's township testing, where they went in and tested private wells across southeast Minnesota. You see with this heat map here that it shows southeast Minnesota lit up with red and orange colored colors, which shows vulnerability over the drinking water standard. From there, we moved on with our development of our program. The goal of the program was to improve soil quality and protect groundwater, of course, the adoption of sustainable practices. One of the big keys with the program was that we wanted to offer flexibility to our producers, our farmers. And with that, we created a menu of options, things like planting cover crops, incentivizing alternative and small grains. Also adding to that, we wanted to keep our livestock producers engaged, and so we developed a hay and grazing activities portion of the program. One of the key parts of this program is that the payments in the program are outcome-based, so they must achieve a performance standard such as growing cover crops to 12 inches, in order to receive a payment. We vetted the program with our local producers, invited farmers into a panel. We laid the program out. They offered up opportunities to make some changes that they thought would be amenable to the farmers in the area, such as setting a limit of 150 acres for the program. We added multiple enhancements, so trying to draw the program into an opportunity for all farmers. And then we have a maximum annual payment rate of $15,750. The benefits of this program are reducing nitrate, improving nitrate retention and that biomass, limiting soil erosion, increasing soil microbiology. You can see it's a multi-benefit program. Just a quick overview of the program itself, piloted in 2023. We started to sign up in the fall of 2023, anticipated maybe signing up 2025 producers, just to make sure the program worked like we wanted to do, that the software was easy for them to get signed up. We had 52 producers sign up over 6,000 acres of cover crops. Total of 66 producers in 23, 113 producers in 24. We have 118 to date in 25, and we still have signups coming in. If you look at the overall amounts of programs of acres certified in the program, 6,000 in 23, almost 13,000 in 24. Right now, we've got nearly 10,000 acres of cover crops signed into the program for 2025. One of the bonuses of our program that we've been finding is we ask them questions like, how many acres of cover crops will you plant in this season? And we're finding that we're getting a 2-to-1 benefit of additional, for each acre we're certifying and paying for, we're getting an additional acre enrolled under the program. We know science is a big part of this, and we want to have some data. This is a data-driven program. This is Rice Creek tile samples. As you can see, there was a really robust sampling. 984 samples were taken over these 5 years, 2019 to 2024. Over that time, we saw a 27% reduction in nitrate from these tile samples. If you look at the picture down in the lower right-hand corner, that's an example of the cover crops that were grown in the Rice Creek area. Our program grows a much more robust cover crop with a minimum growth height of 12 inches. This is another example of data collected at our Olmsted County Soil Health Farm. There's a lot of lines here. I realize that. The red line in the middle is the 10 parts per million. That's the drinking water standard. Everything above that is our corn and soybean years. You see the nitrates go up to nearly 35 parts per million. If you see the green line on the left that drops all the way to the bottom of the graph, that's our oats year. So that's a small grain. You see that the nitrate drops to nearly negligible. It starts very high because there's a residual during a drought year. The soybean year was 2024. So coming out of a drought year into the next season, we started with very high nitrate. That dropped right off as the plants were growing.
Mr. Legge, we have a couple more testifiers. If you could wrap up your
sure.
presentation. Then Kevin Connolly and Jeff Pago, I assume, are here. Why don't Mr. Connolly, why don't you come on up? And Mr. Langer, can you wrap it up? Okay. No, you could. I didn't mean to say you had to stop. Just
okay.
Give us a good ending.
Yeah, just to estimate benefits, direct program payments resulted in 295,000 pounds of nitrogen that did not find their way into groundwater in Olmsted County. The indirect payment, that 2-for-1, is nearly 425,000 pounds. That equates to 17 semi-loads of urea, a commonly used fertilizer in southeast Minnesota, not finding its way into Olmsted's groundwater. Key takeaways, it's a great program for farmers, great farmer engagement. It's outcome-based, so there's measurable results. And then The farmers and community members that we're talking to, not only in Olmsted County, but in the counties that surround Olmsted, really want to see this program come into Olmsted County. So we appreciate your support. Thank you.
Heard a lot of good things about it. Mr. Connolly, identify yourself and proceed.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman and House Ag Finance Committee. My name is Kevin Connolly. I'm a third-generation farmer. On our dairy farm, we raise beef, corn, beans, hay, and oats. And yes, I'm a proud founding member of the Oat Mafia from southern Minnesota. I'm a past SWCD supervisor and a founding member of the Binary Farmers. In addition to this, I've been an active cover cropper since 2012. The Olmsted County Soil Health Program was put together by our SWCD staff. Upon completion, they brought in a number of area farmers and allowed us to tweak it to fit the landscape. This program has been incredibly successful in Olmsted County in generating both new farmers and new acreage enrollment. This has been both on the cover crop and the small grain side, which have both been very successful on our farm. There are many advantages. Three I'd like to highlight specifically are erosion, both wind and water, water infiltration, and nitrate reduction. First of all, erosion. The wind erosion. We've all seen the ditches full of snert, the dirt on top of the snow. This can be significantly reduced through cover crops. By growing and establishing a cover crop, we can reduce the wind erosion and the dirt in the ditches. You can see this was pointed out to us a number of years ago. This is a dime. The width of this dime, we were told, if you take the width of that dime in topsoil erosion, that's 3 to 4 ton. When that blows off a field, that's going somewhere. So by doing that, by reducing some of that wind erosion, we can save our township, our county, and our state some tax dollars from cleaning out the ditches. Second, water erosion. This erosion is a commonly understood one, as we've all seen the fields that are gullied and washed out. Through using cover crops, we can avoid these washouts and keep our topsoil in place and out of the rivers and lakes. Next would be water infiltration. A lot of the benefits of cover crops come from their ability to increase water infiltration. They do this by having 3 times the root mass below the ground as they do seed above it. And I can tell you this because we've dug our cover crops for many years. This opens up the soil. On our farm, I can tell you that the fields that we've had cover crop the longest are also our steepest sloped, and we no longer have waterways in them. We don't need them. The soils absorb it. Last but not least, nitrates. Our Byron Area Farmers group voluntarily started working with the University of Minnesota Extension in 2015, sampling tile lines down in the Olmsted County area. What this showed us was that the water running through these tile lines that had cover crops above them significantly reduced the nitrate levels when compared to the standard till ground with no covers. Not only was it significantly lower on the standard till ground, but it was well under the 10 parts per million of drinking water, many times in that 2 to 3 parts per million. Additionally, cover crops sequester nitrogen, which prevents it from leaching into the water, and it also puts it back into the soil profile so we can use it for next year and the year after when we continuously cover crop.
Thank you.
Furthermore, I just have one more bit. Furthermore, this program involves small grains, which have taken off in our area. We not only realize we can grow food-grade oats with this program, but we can do it well. This is not our grandfather's oats anymore. These are oats that have test weight and yield, and the best part of this is by telling our story of sustainability, we have developed many markets in our oats. Oats greatly change the nitrate load on our land and allow us to increase our crop rotation. This gives everyone an opportunity to have a 3-crop rotation. In summary, this program has been a huge benefit for farmer engagement and is outcome-based with measurable results. My only ask of the board today is that you take this program and make it region-wide and let the other farmers in southern Minnesota enjoy the same benefits that we do in Olmsted County. Thank you.
Mr. Connolly, thank you much. Is Mr. Pagel here? Jeff, come on up. Appreciate you bringing your testimony. We are rapidly running out of time, but Jeff, identify yourself and proceed.
Chair Anderson, members of the committee, my name is Jeff Pagel. I'm a third-generation dairy farmer from Eota, which is located in Olmsted County. On my family's farm, we grow corn, soybeans, alfalfa, oats, and cover crops. I serve on the Minnesota Farm Bureau Board of Directors representing Southeast Minnesota, as well as the Southeast Minnesota Nitrate Strategies Collaborative Work Group. This program is, to break it down simply, it's farmer-friendly. It provides different options for farmers to adopt. Having results-based incentives allows farmers to choose what works best for their operation. On our farm, we have utilized this program to expand our cover crop usage and have also added oats as another crop for our rotation. We utilized some of our cover crop for feed, allowing us to hit the 2-foot growing height that was talked about in the program. The oats allows us an additional cash crop along with the straw for feed and bedding. We're able to utilize both of those on our dairy. After the oats are harvested, we're able to come back in and drill in a multi-species cover crop and basically start the process over again. By providing incentives that defray the cost of trying new crops and practices, the program has truly helped our farm expand our cover crop use and experiment with new and different ideas. Expanding this initiative regionally would empower more farmers like me to adopt proven soil health practices through results-based incentives and straightforward certification. This approach respects farmers' choices and adapts to our diverse operations, ensuring both environmental and economic sustainability. Thank you, Representative Smith, for bringing the bill forward. I'd also like to thank Representative Jacob for his work on this issue, on the water issue in southeast Minnesota, and note our support for House File 452, which would create the same program using dollars from the Clean Water Fund. I urge the committee to support this legislation, and thank you for the opportunity to testify.
Mr. Pagel, thank you. Very good testimony. We are running out of time. Any last words, Representative Smith?
Only to say thank you so much to the committee for hearing this bill. If you haven't, please look through the materials that we provided in your packets. There's letters of support from counties surrounding Olmsted, including Goodhue, Houston, Rice, Maurer, Wabasha, and some other organizations that are worth a look. Thank you.
With that, your House file will be held over. Members, seeing it's time to end the meeting, our meeting is adjourned. Thank you.